I would like to introduce Harold H. from Iowa.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bill. Members of the clergy, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here this evening and to finally have an opportunity to make a meeting such as this, the Intergroup Fellowship, and a special greeting to all of those who have come so far to be here and join us this evening. I've received a lot of advice this evening. I have an armload of papers and letters and things that some of you have handed me since I arrived this evening. I want all of you to know that I'll look at every one of them. I promise you that. If I'd have bought a truckload of money, I've had enough requests for it here this evening that it could have all gone. And I'm expecting more before the evening is over. But I'd like you to know that the Reverend and the Father here handle the business with God. I'm an intermediary, really, at a lower level. And I cannot deliver everything that everyone wants by any connection. Someone here tonight asked me when I quit drinking. And as I was thinking about it, I think the first time was in 1943. The second time was 1944. The third time was 1945. Twice in 1946, and so on, once for 14 months. And then I knew I had it made. 14 months. Anyone that can quit for 14 months can drink right. Would you all agree with that? How many of you made it that long? Then I was sure I could handle two drinks, you know, that's all. All I'd do is watch it, stop at two, and everything would be fine. Well, I did that for a number of times. Then I decided that there was a better plan. All I had to do was watch the clock, and if I didn't drink one over every half hour, everything would be fine. Well, that part worked so well that I thought, well, you know, now I've got it made. I'm a social drinker. And then I woke up one morning, 150 miles from home. I didn't know what day it was or how many days had passed. And I thought, there it went again. You know, I'm right back in the same old rut again. Since I've come to office and public life in America, and since some years have passed, since I've taken my last drink, a lot of people have really wondered whether I ever was a drunk or an alcoholic or not. You know, I rather hate trying to prove that I was. But sometimes in a group like this, I think it's essential to know, you know, that last week I had a call to go and visit a man. Why, after work in the evening, I went to his apartment in Washington. He hadn't had any food since the 3rd of February. He was drinking, but he couldn't swallow food, broth, or anything else. I asked him how much he drank each day, and naturally I doubled that, at least, from what he told me. I figured I was probably a little short at that. And I was convinced that the man was probably within two or three days of death, you know, unless I could convince him that he had to have hospitalization and something should happen. And I sometimes get disgusted, you know, when people don't want to listen when they're obviously so sick. And we talked and talked and talked that night, and he finally became convinced that I'd sort of been drugged. In the course of talking, you know, I mentioned the fact that I'd been in several jails myself. He said, hell, I've never been in jail. I'm not an alcoholic. He hadn't had any food for 30 days, but because he hadn't been in jail, he's not an alcoholic, you know. Well, when I was drinking, I couldn't afford to hide the way he was hiding. It seems rather strange to a lot of people, you know, that they don't want to be associated with us who have diagnosed ourselves as alcoholics. And I can remember my own attitudes and relationship with that a lot of years back. When I first went to an AA meeting, I didn't go because I thought I needed Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to take a friend. Now, this friend had a real problem. His father came to me and said, well, maybe you can help him. So he wouldn't listen to me, so I suggested that we both go to an AA meeting. It was some 35, 40 miles away from our hometown. And we went over there that night. I had a terrific time because come 6:30 and his wife was going to divorce him. His father had told me he was about to lose his job, you know, everything was out the window. But his wife called me up at 6:30 and said he's changed his mind. He isn't going with you. And I said, you tell him I'm going to be there at 6:45, and he's either going with me or whip me. One of the two. I've listened to all the crap I'm going to listen to. We're going to a meeting tonight, both of us. I've never been to one, but by God, he's no better than I am. We'll go together. So we went over to that meeting, and it was like a homecoming. I walked in. I wondered where all those guys had been. You know, I'd been missing them for 2 or 3 years. And there they were, all gathered together, looking well and happy. And one guy got up in front of the room, made a talk, and he addressed the whole talk to me. How many of you remember that first meeting? Every word that guy said, I couldn't figure out whether he'd been following me or what. But it sunk home. And in those days, back in Iowa, they had a chip presentation. You know, and I didn't go to join AA. I went with my friend. You all understand that. He needed AA. So it embarrassed me terribly. They called me up in front of the group for a chip presentation to give me a chip. And I just, you know, didn't know whether I was going to accept that chip or not. I stood up there with my hands in my pockets like I am now, and I listened to a little speech that went along with it. Then I thought, well, now I ought to have at least a week to think this over. You know, I don't want to be deceptive, but I'm not ready for that chip yet. I just don't think I'm an alcoholic in spite of all this. But they took it because it was more embarrassing not to take it than it was to take it. And I thought, well, the guy said throw it away. If you ever want to take a drink anyway, I'll throw it away whether I do or not. At least I'll be out of here. But I went home and I thought about that all week. And I called up my friend a week later and said, let's go back to Storm Lake. And he said, all right. So we went together again. And I kept going back to AA. The more I went, the more confused I got, frankly, for a period of time. I spent a lot of time in that first 2 years, and all of you, I don't know how many of you had nightmares when you quit drinking. I did for about 2 years, you know, those horrible nightmares where you wake up sweating, you're drunk, it's real, you can even taste it in your mouth, you're dying, you wake up suddenly and look around the room to see where you're at and think, my God, I've done it again, how did it happen, where'd I start, and what went wrong? You suddenly realize, you know, it's the subconscious drilling in on you again. At the end of 2 years, I went out to sober up the world. Everyone I thought drank too much, I tried to drag him into AA, whether he wanted to go or not. I went into more homes and insulted more people and got told to mind my own business more often than anyone I know of. After 3 or 4 months of that, I was almost ready to get drunk, and I decided maybe I ought to take care of number one. Maybe I ought to take care of myself. And not go out to sober up the world. So I slowed down a little. Of course, you all understand that at the end of 2 years, I knew the answer to alcoholism. I knew everything there was to know about it. In fact, some things that other people hadn't thought of before, I was sure I knew at that point. But as time passed, slowly but surely, I suddenly began to realize that I really didn't know very much about alcoholism or anything else. I was set in AA meetings 2 or 3 times a week. I listened to people tell about their drinking experiences, tell their story, make their pitch. Then I'd listen to the after-meeting discussions of why, whether I'm an alcoholic or not. You know, one guy says, well, I've been sober 4 years, I haven't had a drink, why would you call myself an alcoholic? I don't drink. Another guy says, I've been sober 15 years and I'm an alcoholic. Finally, after listening to all this baloney for a long time about whether I was or whether I wasn't, I finally decided it didn't make any difference. Really, what the definition was, what other people thought I was, or what I thought I was. There's one simple fact in my life. When I drink, I'm irrational, I'm insane, I can't control alcohol. When I don't drink, I'm a different person. And that's really all I needed to know. I go back, as I told Bill earlier this afternoon. When I quit drinking, I didn't tell my wife that I quit. Again, because I'd told her so many times that I knew she wouldn't believe me anyway. I wasn't sure myself, you know, how we are. I didn't know. I hoped and I wanted to, because when I made that decision, and I'll share with you this point tonight, shortly previous to that, having hurt everyone I loved, in the worst ways that a man can hurt his family and his mother and father and his friends, I've experienced all of those. Knowing the terrible loneliness and the sickness and the desperation in the pit of your stomach and the helplessness of being unable to do anything about what you're doing or seemingly unable to control it. Like so many of you, I decided that there was no use going on in life. I was going to end it. It was going to be a nice, clean job. I loaded the gun, went in the bathroom, locked the door, and got in the bathtub so I wouldn't mess up the house. And I think probably for the first time in my life, I'd prayed most of my life, usually by bargaining with God. It was always a bargain, you know. You do this, I'll do this. Parachute prayer, I'm in great trouble, God help me, you know. And when everything turned out all right, I forgot about it rapidly. But I really, at that point, just cried out in simple agony, God help me. You know, I don't want to go on. I can't go on. I can't manage my life. I've destroyed everything I love and everything I believe in. If there's any reason for me to live at all, you better tell me now, because I'm not going to go any further this way. Something happened to me at that moment. You can call it coincidence, an answer to prayer, cowardice, I don't care what you call it. But I felt it in my heart. I felt it in my heart. And for all of you that loaded the gun or thought about it, wish you had sometimes, as I did, before the last drunk. You can recall, perhaps, if you go back to that moment, the agony that you were sweating with, praying for, and doubting, the hopelessness of your total existence, and the wonder of why you were ever even born. For I decided, I felt an answer. I didn't hear a voice or see a vision, as I know people who have, and I believe them, when they really prayed in desperation. But I felt it deep inside of me, that I could make it if I really tried this time. So I started patiently and slowly, day by day and hour by hour. That's been a long time ago now, but I'll never forget it, no matter how many of the days in my life. I decided at that point to turn my life over to God. I surrendered completely and simply said, you know, direct my life wherever you want me to go, you show me and I'll try to follow. Well, in those days, I was a working man with my hands. I drove a truck for a living. I supported my wife, three children. I was never ashamed to work, and I still keep my chauffeur's license because there are a lot of people trying to send me back to it in my business now. And I keep it current. But my life changed slowly. In those early years, I started back to work in my church, incidentally, Reverend, which is the Methodist Church. I hadn't been back there really seriously since my youth. I eventually became a member of the Finance Commission. I sang in the choir, and I sang for funerals and weddings, and I taught Sunday school class, and I did all the things that a good Christian is supposed to do in his church, I guess. I was a working churchman. It filled about half my life, and the other half of my spare time was taken up in AA meetings. I organized the ministry and got them one at a time at AA meetings, and the doctors in the community and surrounding towns, and got them one at a time into my AA meetings. Started an AA meeting in my hometown in the basement of the office building and where I rented space. Cleaned it up. Started organizing truckers in the northwestern part of the state. And I was such a good organizer that then I was hired by an organization to organize truckers, and I continued that. And I actually accidentally got into politics. Because there was so much wrong with what was going on, I went to the governor after a hearing before the State Commerce Commission to protest the inadequacy, the horrible decision-making and corruptness in that commission. And the governor said to me, if you're so upset about it, why don't you run for the office yourself? And I went home and thought about that and prayed about it. And I thought to myself, in the final analysis, in a free society, in a great democracy, it is our responsibility individually not to blame everyone else for what's wrong, but to do what we can ourselves. And maybe that'll change it. I live in a town of 2,300 people. The next day, I declared myself a candidate for the State Commerce Commission. And everyone in town had a big laugh. You know, that was the funniest thing that had happened there since the fire whistle went bad. And but I campaigned for a year and a half, mostly with the laboring people and the truck drivers around the state. I didn't have any money. And to the surprise of everyone, including myself, I got elected. And I had to go to Des Moines, then, the capital of Iowa, and foreign surroundings in the midst of a business that I little understood, the way of the life of politics. I moved in, I found out they'd burned everything in the files. The desk was still there, but there wasn't even a chair to sit on when I moved in. They didn't leave any records of what had been happening ahead of me. Well, I fired everyone in the place. That was a good beginning. I figured that way, whoever was crooked, I was bound to get them in the process. Not everyone, but where the real trouble was. And started to rebuild that commission. And then 2 years later, because of inadequacies in the political party to which I belong and the difference and division in the party, I ran for governor. And I was defeated in the primary. 2 years after that, I ran again against an incumbent governor and defeated him. I ran successfully for 3 terms. I was attacked in my seeking re-election the second time as being a drunk. An old drunken driving charge against me in the state of Florida was brought up 3 days before the election in the campaign. Charged that I was a liar, deceptive and deceitful, misleading the people about what I was doing. And I simply said to the people of Iowa, yes, I am an alcoholic. I had asked the press prior to this time not to write anything about it, that I was an alcoholic, that I was sober, but I would appreciate it. Respect to me, unless it was taken up in the public forum, that they would not write about it, and they hadn't to any extent. But when this charge came out publicly, there was nothing they could do about it but write about it. So they wrote about it. And I simply said in debate that day, which was a statewide television debate, I regret that my opponent has saw fit to drag out incidents of the past that happened during the days that I was a heavy drinker and a practicing alcoholic. I admit to my alcoholism, but I haven't had a drink for years. I regret that part of my life. I wish it hadn't happened, that I'd been a different person. But I can't alter that. The only thing I can say to you today is that I am a different person and hope you'll believe that on the basis of what I've done and the way I live. And now I didn't come here to talk about something that happened 10 years ago, but to talk about the issues of today. And that's all I intend to talk about from here on in this campaign, regardless of what my opponent says. The people of my state responded with an overwhelming re-election of me to the office of governor, the greatest plurality ever given a candidate for any political office in the history of my state. I am deeply proud of the people of Iowa. They recognized my illness, they respected it, but they also respected my integrity, and they supported it. In time of crisis. A national magazine then did a story on my life. Look magazine. It went around the world. They were going to write it, whether I cooperated or whether I didn't. You can't stop people from writing stories about you in public office, no matter what they want to write. So I decided in final analysis to cooperate with them. It was better to get it as close to the truth as possible rather than to have it be colored, you know, the way it can be colored unless truth is known in cooperation. I knew that I would be attacked by members of Alcoholics Anonymous everywhere as a result of that story, and I was. I got several thousand letters from AA members around this country. Most of them damning me and condemning me. An example of the worst was one from the secretary of an AA group in Florida. And started out, you dirty SOB, I hope you're drunk by the time you get this letter. Because anyone who would break his anonymity at a public level doesn't deserve sobriety. And I wrote him back and said, friend, I hope you will pray for my serenity. Obviously, you have found yours. So all of you have had questions in your mind about my anonymity. It happened against my will that I was projected as probably the world's number one alcoholic today. But I'll tell you the truth, I have no regrets about it. Because tens of thousands of people are sober today because the story has been told. But I landed in Tokyo in 1965, and a piece appeared in the English-speaking Tokyo newspaper, and I got a call in the hotel that evening. A person saying, I've been sober 28 days and I'm dying. God, can you help me? And I said, well, I've got to go to a dinner tonight. And said, well, I won't make it through the night. I said, all right, I won't go to the dinner. Can you come to the hotel? I don't know any place about getting around in this town. That person today is living in Kenya, sober. We went to an AA meeting in Tokyo, one of the strangest AA meetings I've ever been to, and I've been to a lot of them around the world. There was an Air Force colonel, United States. There was a colonel from the Australian Army. There were British military personnel there. There were enlisted American and British personnel there. There were two Chinese prostitutes with a Protestant minister as their interpreter. Who better to interpret for them, you know, unless it would be a Catholic priest. I can't think of anyone better qualified. But it was truly a world gathering. People, and they asked me to speak. They were desperate. They'd been meeting, you know, with new people by way of infusion and new ideas and thoughts are sounding different. So we met together that night. The meeting drug on, and questions and answers, and it lasted for 2 or 3 hours. And I spent the rest of the night drinking coffee with the person that I'd gone to the meeting with. If you can imagine a governor driving down back narrow streets of Tokyo, winding up in an alley and climbing 3 flights of crooked stairs with boxes piled on them to a little back room in a country you'd never visited before and wondering what on earth you were getting into, particularly since the person who had called and asked for help was a good-looking lady. And I really began to search my soul at that point, reciting the steps and a couple of prayers too, being a real alcoholic. But to this day, we have a meeting, an AA meeting, by mail once every month. We exchange letters because there are no meetings that she can attend where she presently lives. I got off a plane once in Central America. The American Consul General met me at the plane. I was governor, but I thought it was an official visit. But he said, brother, I'm one of the fellowship. And I said, great. At first I didn't take, you know, so many people say that to me. I don't know what they're talking about, the Elks, you know, or what it might be. And he said, no, I'm an AA. And I said, good. He said, could we have a meeting? And I said, when? He said, now. And I said, well, how many are there? And he said, I got one other guy. Can you come? I said, I'm there, you know. Where are we? So we went, the three of us, spent 2 hours with an AA meeting. Desperate. I could go on and on and on what has happened to the mothers and the fathers and the letters I've received. Just this last Christmas from a man. Started out something like, "Dear Senator, you don't know me, you never heard of me, but I want to say thanks. I saw you on television one night. I was dead drunk. I thought I was an important person. I'd really destroyed myself and my family. And I thought to myself, my God, if that man could admit publicly that he had trouble with alcohol, what's wrong with me?" And he said, "I called AA in the phone book." He said, "I'm having my first anniversary and I wish you'd come. Because I'd like to say thanks personally." I don't say this to tell you that I have accomplished anything, ladies and gentlemen, but I do say this to tell you. In industry, entertainment, business, theater, whatever it might be, one person did. And you all know who that is. It was Mercy McCambridge. And God bless her, as a result of her work, thousands of women in America today are being reached also. Now maybe that is wrong. We didn't break our anonymity as AA members. We talk in public as alcoholics. I try not to mention my fellowship with AA in public, in respect for the tenets of this great institution. But I do retain the individual right to speak in public, freely and openly, about my problem with alcohol. And I will continue to do that, and I well recognize the dangers involved in it. But to go on for a moment, if I might. In the last few years, things have been happening that I didn't think I would ever see happen. I stopped on the way up here this morning at Gateway Farm. When Bill turned the corner to go into there, and I looked at that beautiful building, and I said, "You know, a respectable drunk wouldn't be seen in that place." You know, after all the shams and the shanties and the dying in the alleys and sitting in the drunk tanks, damned in the Bible and condemned every step of the way for generations, suddenly alcoholism is a respectable disease. You know, even politicians and actresses admit they drink too much occasionally. Everyone knew it anyway, but now we admit it. Sort of like the Methodists in their annual conference now, where they decide they can drink in front of one another. But I really think, ladies and gentlemen, that we're seeing a dawn of a new day for the sick alcoholic. And there is no injustice to the AA Fellowship in that. The AA Fellowship, I predict tonight, will grow and grow and grow in the immediate years ahead. And the 12-step work that's so essential to be done, every person in this room would have so much to do if they want to reach out to do it that it's unbelievable. The pigeons you'll have will be lined up. They won't be one and two at a time. And incidentally, while it crosses my mind, as I was telling some of the people earlier, you know, since I came into this fellowship, my clientele has changed considerably. Used to be the working man, you know, and the truck driver and the guy on the street that I worked with. Now I get the guys with the PhD. You know, I'm at the real strata, you know. I want to tell you something. I can't see the difference between a drunk up here and a drunk down here. They're all drunks. Some of them can afford to stay drunk a little longer than I could afford to stay drunk. But nevertheless, the problem is the same. And it's no respecter of status, symbol, wealth, or anything else. But we are coming at an age where now, even in the military, and I was an alcoholic in the military, I'm convinced I was born an alcoholic. I never had a normal drink any day of my life. From the first time I ever took a drink, I drank abnormally. For years, I wondered why. Now, in medical testimony I've received before the committee again that I chair, it's been indicated by medical researchers that they believe there's a strong probability that somewhere between 30 to 50% of alcoholics are born with a biochemical imbalance in their system. And that as a result of that, they have an intolerance to alcohol. Heredity factor is strong. In some research studies being made, as high as 75% of alcoholics have had an alcoholic parent or grandparent in the family structure. And it comes down that way. As you all know, in my part of the country, we call it the Irish disease. But there are certain national groups of people who are affected by alcohol different than other national groups of people and ethnic groups of people. The American Indian, the Irish, I could go on with groups that are affected differently. Now, there must be reasons behind it that go beyond cultural reasons. They may very well be genetic. I do not know. From a long way back in the evolution of man. But we're still not reaching out to these people. We're not doing anything really to reach out into the field to see that we can do more to the black people in America. The development of programs, black programs, where blacks can reach blacks are very few. And yet the problem is tremendous in the inner city. But primarily blacks live in the large cities of America today. One Indian reservation in America, 85% of the teenagers from 15 to 18 years old have been in jail as a result of a drinking problem. 85%. The suicide rate was the highest suicide rate in the nation today because of alcoholism. You all know the statistics, 28,000 dead on our highways a year ago as a result of alcohol relationship to drink. 50% of the men and women in our prisons are there because of the alcohol relation to the crime for which they committed. One in every six veterans' beds, average in the nation, filled with an alcoholic patient. Emotionally warped children, broken homes, and abandoned by the millions in this country as a result of alcoholism. The courts glutted, the jails full of people trying to handle the alcoholic in a way they don't know how to handle it. The mental institutions, 40% of the beds in this country in our mental institutions are filled with alcoholic patients. We say there are 9 million chronic alcoholics, another 9 million problem drinkers, each affecting disastrously at least three other people, for a total of 72 million Americans. We know that 89 million Americans drink, and more, and yet the age of the alcoholic is coming down. Down, down, down. Now you go to an AA meeting, you see kids 17, 18, 19, 20 years old. When we started, you know, you didn't see those kids in AA meetings. I wish to God someone had told me at 17 that there was such a thing as the disease of alcoholism. Maybe 15 years sooner, I might have found a way out. In my opinion, alcoholism is preventable. Something can be done about it. An early interdiction of the problem can in some ways slow it down, if not prevent it. Well, I realize that would cut into future ages membership in AA, but wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if we could accomplish that one day? As you go on down this list of statistics, which are horrifying, really, you know, over $8 billion a year in industrial loss. I never thought I'd live to see the day in my life that I'd find one chief law enforcement officer in America say that we should no longer treat alcoholics as criminals. But last December, I attended a dinner honoring Brink Smithers in New York City, and the Attorney General of the United States was the main speaker. And his whole address was to the thrust that alcoholism is a disease and the alcoholic in America should no longer be treated as a criminal. He should not be put in a jail just because he is intoxicated. He should not be sentenced to prison because he is intoxicated. There is no help for him there. What a tremendous problem this is. What are we going to do with alcoholics when there is no way to handle them? Every state in the union needs to pass a new state law, which has already been recommended by the Attorney General, the Secretary of HEW, myself, I might add, which was drawn out by the Uniform Commission on State Law, which is a model law so that alcoholics are not sentenced to jail or prison. We passed an Alternative Sentencing Act in Iowa when I was governor, allowing a judge to sentence an individual for treatment rather than to prison if the problem was alcohol. I could give you example after example into infinity of the cases I have personally read of injustice, in my opinion. One poor man who on his fourth time conviction of a felony, he stole three chainsaws and traded them for 3/5 of whiskey. And because under Iowa law, he is required to be sentenced as an habitual criminal to 40 years in prison. To 40 years in prison, the man is an alcoholic, not a criminal. What justice is there being accomplished by this type of structure of law in our country, in America today? Now, we can do something about this. Why do I talk about this at an AA meeting? Because you are the missionaries of America in a field in which there is a need so great. We still don't know how to measure it. We don't know what causes alcoholism. We don't know the answers to alcoholism. We all know, as far as I'm concerned, that the only sure way is to arrest alcoholism by not drinking. And to teach otherwise, in my opinion, is a mistake. I have never in my life met the person. I've heard of some who said they were alcoholics, later conquered the problem and now can drink socially. Well, brothers and sisters, I've seen a hell of a lot more who tried it. And they never made it, not a one of them. It's a mistake. If you think you're there, you better put that dime in the phone and call your sponsor right now. Because you're going to wind up in the can and on your can and in bad shape if you try that little trip. But we can do something about this in America, much more than the door is even opening today, if we wish to do it. A part of the problem in the areas of alcoholism, ladies and gentlemen, is jealousy. I'm going to speak very blunt to you about that for a moment. The jealousy of the different groups working with alcoholics. Each jealous of what the other group is doing in the field of alcoholism. Each saying their way is the only way and there is no other way. And if you don't do it our way, you can't succeed and no one can ever get sober. I'd remind you what the Master said of people doing good works in his name who were not one of the 12. And he said, if they're doing good works in my name, then leave them alone and let them do their work. When I started developing alcoholism programs in the state of Iowa, the worst opponents I had were alcoholics who were saying there is only one way and that way is AA. Well, I think AA is the greatest way to sobriety in the world. Don't ever have a moment of doubt in your mind about that, but there are others. I don't subscribe to them personally, but they work for some people. And we shouldn't be the ones who want to cut our throats or the throats of other people who may find a way to sobriety by some other method. That's heresy, then I'm a heretic. Because I believe that anyone can attain this sobriety if the spark is lit, to have a desire, a true desire to quit. The old saying that all of us have heard so many times, you know, if you want to drink, that's your business. If you want to quit, that's our business. But it still works that way. I get every year thousands of calls from women who want me to sober up their husbands. Letters from mothers who want me to sober up their sons. Letters from husbands who want advice of how to handle an alcoholic wife or a child. Some days I feel like a national chaplain in the field of alcoholism because I don't have the answers any more than you do to most of it. But we do usually have a policy of calling the person back if there is a number or an address that we can find by phone and saying, if you want help, we'll contact someone in your town to call on you right away. We recommend this. And 9 times out of 10, I go to AA to find someone in AA, to find him in that town, to give him the name of the person, to get over to the house or wherever they at, talk to them, and try and help them find a way back. Many of them do. I'm sure that some of them don't. I called many of them myself on the phone and talked to them. I wish, ladies and gentlemen, that I could impart to you the urgency that I think we're involved in our country today. Because when the Attorney General made this announcement, I hope you realize the undertaking to really face this problem. Every police department in the nation has to be retrained in how handling the alcoholics. There must be facilities for handling them also, physical facilities, not only for detoxification, but a place to take a man or a woman who is intoxicated too when they are picked up. And who picks them up? The police? Or are we going to volunteer to have an emergency telephone? If someone is intoxicated in your city, we'll go pick them up. And we'll get kicked in the shins and spit in the face and cursed instead of the police for a while, as they have been for years dealing with us. You know, and it's not very pleasant for the police to be kicked and cursed and slugged and everything else and dealing with an alcoholic. We curse them plenty because we don't like them throwing our friends in the tank. But in the process, they are cursed too. But of course, many of them are victims of the disease themselves. And they need help. Every city in the country should have a program for employees. Every state. The federal system now has one. We've just instituted one in the Pentagon for the armed services. Industrially, and the unions, and Bill, and the work they have done, tremendous work in cooperation with me in supporting the Hughes bill, appropriations for that bill, $50 million in the country. Yes, these are things that are being done. Maybe it shouldn't be talked at in an AA meeting. But nonetheless, it's the practical aspect of the fact that there are 18 million people drinking too much, at least. And the problems, related problems that go with it, we must do something about it. And now, if I may conclude rather rapidly on a note that I think is vitally important to all of us. We in this fellowship have a unique position in life. We're really the chosen people of God. Not only is the opening prayer indicated, but certainly, you know, everything that has happened in our life, that we were lost and we are found, that we are dead and we are born. But the only way we can keep is to give. And to love, we must love. Everything that is taught in the great religions, and certainly the Christian religion that most of us follow, is what we should be taught to practice. And the last step says that having taken these steps, we experienced a spiritual awakening. Unless you have experienced that, you obviously haven't taken the steps very well. And in that spiritual awakening is tolerance, and understanding, compassion, patience, love, and reaching out to one another. We all need to be loved. Alcoholics most of all. How desperately we have needed to be loved and understood. Surely in the midst of our need, we can now reach out in our love to those who still cry out in agony as we have cried out for help. Surely as God has given us the grace to live again and to walk again and to get up and look at the day, and the snow doesn't bother me because God has shown me that everything is beautiful. The snow is beautiful. The wind is beautiful. To feel it is a great feeling because so many days I couldn't feel anything. Even to hurt sometimes is a pleasure compared to the agonies that we have suffered. And to know that in that hurt we can grow stronger by it. Yes, these are the important things in life. Let's don't cloud the issue so firmly in trying to reach out in the structure of our everyday living, no matter what it may be, to forget the simplicity of what we are. We can change things. If every person in this room would really accept the challenge of AA and a commitment and seek that spiritual experience fully, and as we stay in the 12 steps, turn our life over to God as we understand it. Turn it over. Brother, you watch what happens. You won't believe it. God has a surprise for you every day of your existence. And it won't stop the day you leave the body. It'll go on. And on and on. The challenge of what we are is understanding our union with God. The lost are found. They are gathered today with their families. We have all been sick and we are well. We've all been in degradation and misery and we are happy and cheered with joy. And we should all love God from the very center of our being for what He has allowed us to do. The greatest privilege of all mankind to help someone in need. What a privilege that is. Nothing can match it. Wealth, position, status. I'd willingly give all those things up if being there deprived me of the right to reach out to my fellow man. Now this is all we are asked to do, and it's the simplest of things that returns itself so abundantly that we can't even avoid it. Anyone to look at my life and say it isn't a miracle is blind. When I look at myself and what I was, where I am, when I look at my wife who put up with so much and could look at me tenderly and say, I love you, when I look at my youngest daughter and said, Dad, I know I've been to AA meetings with you all my life, but I never saw you drink. And I say, thank God, one of my children never saw me drink. One of my children never saw me drink. And I look at my grandchildren, and I thank God again, you know, that this is possible. I don't want to get maudlin about this, but I do think it's important, extremely important, to know that if we have really taken these steps in AA and are willing to take them as they should be taken, you cannot avoid that spiritual experience. I've really enjoyed this opportunity to be here in Youngstown and this opportunity to share some thoughts and ideas with you this evening. I realize that in every group there are new members and there are old members and there are those in every span in between. That there are Al-Anons and Al-Ateens and non-alcoholics and alcoholics. And that this is one of those mixed groups. I have shared with you tonight on the basis of one human being to another, not as a public official, but as a man. I hope that in the process of doing that, that your life will be enriched as much as mine has been by meeting you tonight. Thank you very kindly.